Hello?
Yeah. Okay.
You're on.
Okay. All right. What I'd like to discuss tonight is basically I'm going to get around to it. But I'd like to discuss a problem. It has to do with a class I intended to give anyways. But it's something which is very currently on the lips of everyone since the incident in Oklahoma. And that is, people are asking, the major question people are asking is, how could this happen? Or, more specifically, how could God allow this to happen? Then, of course, people ask, what about innocent children? And how could God allow innocent children to die? Okay? Now, this is a question, a very, very powerful question. And, of course, the standard answer is, well, God takes care of them, and that's it. But obviously, they're better off. But obviously, we don't think that people are better off that way. Otherwise, we would do things ourselves in such a manner, which obviously is absurd. So the answer, really, the general answer, obviously, is very lacking and is not satisfying. I will. I would like to tonight attempt to. I won't say answer the question. I will say offer some insight into the question. Okay. Now, we have to understand to begin with that the world that we live in is a world that is created by God and runs according to His will. I emphasize it runs according to His will. What I mean is not according to our fantasies or our designs. However, the world that we live in, God did give us something through which we can have an understanding of how it works. Okay? That is the divine element in our soul, our minds, our intellects, our knowledge, our wisdom. That part of man which has understanding, the divine element, is the tool which God implanted in our soul through which we are capable of gaining knowledge of the world which He created, okay, to a given extent. Never fully. Man will never fully understand the universe, but man will constantly uncover new ideas as he progresses. But the knowledge is infinite, so he'll never reach an end to it, okay? That is what the Torah teaches us. All right, there was a time when some physicists thought that in a few more years we're going to know the whole universe, and that's it. Newton's time, they thought. Just a matter of complications, we understand everything. And the Torah teaches us that such a time will never come, because the universe is God's, as the prophets say, reflect God's infinite wisdom, and therefore you could never come to an end of it. But nevertheless, at the same time, the Torah says we must study, we must understand the world that God gave us, the natural world, the world of Torah, the world of ideas, that's the world of the human world, and we are obligated to understand this and to apply ourselves to this area. And if we do, we gain more insight into the area. So my answer to this question is going to be based on that kind of an approach. I'm not going to give an answer which is going to be emotionally satisfying to human fantasy. That such an answer is not possible, and such an answer is not true according to Torah. It does not exist. But what I would like to do is show some insight, according to Torah, from the Torah itself, into that kind of a question. And that's a big question that bothers everyone. Okay. Now let's go. We just celebrated Passover, so let's just for a moment go to the night of Passover. Okay. Now, there is an interesting question that has very much to do with B'nai Noach, very much to do with it, and that has to do with the basic problem of the religion of B'nai Noach. Of course, you know very well what the most basic problem of the religion of the B'nai Noach is, and what everyone asks as soon as they hear about the religion, the first question they ask is, well, what are we supposed to do? You mean just these seven laws? That's it? Okay, I don't steal, I don't kill, I don't serve idols. Now what? Okay, so the B'nai Noach religion. religion is the only religion in the world, actually, that has no accompanying ritual. There's no ritual in the religion. All right. What does the Ben Noach do? Okay, we know very well that when we say the seven laws, these are the seven societal mandates. But the Ben Noach, in terms of perfection, is involved in pursuit of Torah knowledge, studying, understanding, going to classes, learning on one's own, and pursuing Torah knowledge. That's the essence of the religion. It's not a religion of singing hymns. It's not a sing-song religion. It's a religion of knowledge and understanding. Okay, and also, if one wishes to perform a mitzvah on a voluntary basis, one can do so. But there is no mandated ritual. And of course, this strikes everybody as strange. Why? Why is this so? Well, why should God create such a religion? I believe the answer is found in the night of Passover. Okay, right there in the Bible, we have the answer. You see, you have to understand that for the Torah is, as we always say, as the rabbis say, as the Talmud says, and as anyone who is, by the way, I mean, the oral law is nothing more than a very careful analysis of the written law. And if you look at the written law, you'll find the same principles. And the enemy of Torah is really idolatry and idolatrous practices. Now, what did Moses teach the people? See, Moses became a teacher for the first time. When did Moses become a teacher for the first time? Not when he went to do the miracles. That was, he was a teacher in a sense, in a certain way, but I mean the official teacher of the people, a teacher of Torah. When did he become a Torah teacher? Okay? He was a philosophical teacher when he went to the elders of Israel and discussed the ideas of God and the name of God. Then he was a philosophical teacher. But when did he become a Torah teacher? He became a Torah teacher for the first time when God told him to teach the people that this month is the first of months, and how you set up a halachic calendar, halachic time, and that is found in Exodus 12. And then when he commanded them, he gave them the commandment that on the 10th of this month, once you have a halachic time, so you have day one according to Allah. Now on day 10 there's a commandment, and the commandment is to take a sheep, and he taught them about this sheep, that it was no simple matter. It was to be done in a very specific way, and the certain important concepts, basic concepts, which we will get to. But the most important thing that he taught them was basically the concept of halacha. All right, and the concept of halacha was the very most and fundamental principle that Moses as a teacher taught the Jewish people that night. It involved certain activities. It involved, in that case, it involved the sheep, it involved the eating, the slaughter, the eating, the matzah, the maror, all the things that we are familiar with, at least everyone is familiar with, and most everyone on a superficial level. But the most important thing that he taught them was the concept of halacha. You see, and which means that what they were going to do on that night, the night of Passover, was not a ritual. It was halacha. Halacha is a different kind of a performance. Very special, very separate. Okay? In halacha, we worship God through the mind, through intelligence, through knowledge, through understanding. It is not ritual performance. You see, now you have to understand, what is ritual performance? Ritual performance is an activity, and every primitive religion has it. It's an activity which has symbolic character, and people think that through this symbolic action, they can effectuate a change in reality, which means that if they do, people do things symbolically. They think that somehow or other there's some value, and if I do some symbolic kind of action, that's going to affect the change somewhere in reality, somehow. It's going to affect the change that's going to affect my life, okay? That's why you notice the bombing, they said, was on the 19th of April. Okay, the bombing in Oklahoma. 19th of April. Why? The 19th of April has symbolic importance. 2 years ago, there was the situation with Koresh. And it was also historically... It was the Revolutionary War, the Battle of Lexington, I believe it was, when the American Revolution has a historical significance. So the people choose these dates because they have symbolic meaning to them, as if there's some magic about that date, you know, and that's going to effectuate a change, and this is going to be very helpful. But all religions have these kind of symbolic performances where they believe that by doing something symbolically, you can doing an activity that's symbolic in a private way is going to affect the change in the universe, or at least in their environment. Okay. Now, this is something which Torah is very much against, and that's really the root of idolatry. And Torah teaches man that the only thing that can effectuate a change is an action that is in line with reason, with wisdom, with knowledge. And what we do is not symbolic performances. What we do is halacha. So the most important thing that Moses taught the people was a removal from any kind of ritual. And he had to teach them for 2 weeks before... The teaching began in the began with regard to the new moon, which was the month of Nisan. So they had 2 weeks time to study all the laws that they were about to perform. And if one studies the Torah very carefully and the oral law, which explains every word of the written law, you will see that there are really basic concepts, important concepts, that relate to these commandments that Moses taught them. So it wasn't just an activity of sprinkling blood on the doorpost. It was very important halachic material ought to be found in this area. This was the first teaching area that, of Torah. So from Exodus 12, you see, and the succeeding the entire Exodus 12 contains some of the most fundamental principles of halacha. I'm not going to be able to get to them tonight, probably, but I think it's important that you should understand that the most important thing was for Moses to teach the people that what they're about to do is not some kind of a ritual. The ritual is, God does not want ritual, because ritual is man's attempt to escape into a world of fantasy and imagination and to think that by doing some kind of crazy symbolic action, he's effectuating a change in reality. That's Egyptian. That was the concept of Egypt. The mystical religions and the belief that by a person's concentration of energies and his thought, he can somehow, he has some kind of omnipotence where he can affect reality. This is the primitive religion of man, and Moses taught the people that such an idea is false, but there is a proper way to worship God. That is through a unique instrument, the instrument of halacha, and he had to teach them all about that instrument of halacha and how it works, what the concepts are, and how man can truly serve God. Now, this is expressed, by the way, by the Talmud, and of course, again, when I say the Talmud, and I always emphasize this and reemphasize this, the Talmud is always an explanation of the written law, and everything is always has a source in the written law, the text itself. Okay? Now, the Talmud explains it, the Talmud cites this concept. Its citation is related to Exodus 12:21, okay? And it says, the verse reads as follows. And Moses called the elders of Israel. The elders of Israel always means the intelligent ones of Israel, the leaders of the people. And it says, and he said to them. And then it says that what did he say to them? So he said to them, Let me see. Let me just give me 1 second. See the word, the next word. You see, the next word has the next word is never to be found in other situations. You see, in other words, what it should say. The next word basically is redundant. What the Torah should have said, and he said to them, take for you a sheep for your families. Okay, but there is a word before that. Which means to pull, all right? To draw, to pull, okay? And this really doesn't have any place in this context. For instance, whenever the Torah says, for instance, to take a lulav and esrog, it doesn't use that word mishlu. It just says take. So you have a word over here in the Torah which is redundant, okay? Which is unnecessary and just doesn't belong in the text. Okay? So, whenever we have that, the oral law, always operating on the principle received at Sinai, namely that there are no extra words in the Torah, and that the Torah is God's infinite wisdom, so therefore, this word is not extra, but this word actually has meaning. Okay? Now, what is the meaning of the word mishlu, to pull, to draw? So the rabbis say what it means is you should pull yourself away from idolatry and take the sheep of mitzvah. Okay? So when Moses gave them this law, this is where the rabbis say that the reference is to be found in the careful analysis of the text of the written law. Because there are no extra words in the written law, and when it says that one should draw, pull, it means withdraw from idolatry and take the sheep of mitzvah. What does it mean? It means Moses was going to teach the people a new way of a new kind of religion, okay? This religion is based upon mitzvah, the concept of mitzvah, what mitzvah is, and what the ramifications and the understanding of the institution of mitzvah is, and he was going to pull them away from their ritualistic inclinations, which they were involved in because they were involved, deeply involved in Egyptian society. Okay? So, therefore, what Moses taught the people that night, for that night, was the concept of halacha. And as I said before, there are many important principles which perhaps we will go into, but not right away. I would like to get him deal with the philosophical a little bit tonight before we get back to that. But there are very important principles in that chapter, basic principles of halacha, positive commandments, negative commandments, the different concepts of the types of commandments, and perhaps we'll get back to it. But at this point, let's just keep that in mind, and then let me just take up something else. Okay. Of course, every mitzvah, every commandment in the Torah, is structured according to a very unique method and a science. Actually, it's a science of halacha. But that's every halacha. When a person is proficient in the knowledge of halacha, there is a cohesive system. It's a way of thinking. It's just like a mathematician has a way of thinking mathematically. There's a way of thinking halachically, and it's a unique science of its own. That's true with regard to every mitzvah. But then the question always is the details of the mitzvah. For instance, why? Why did the Torah say, why did God say to sacrifice the Paschal lamb? Okay? Why did God say to sprinkle the blood with the hyssop grass? What's the reason for that? Okay? This is already not the halacha, but the philosophy behind it. So you always have two aspects. You have the structure, which is like the scientific component of it, the way it's structured. Then there is the meta-halacha, which would be like the philosophy of science. You have science, you have the way science works, but then there's much work on the philosophy of science. Man isn't happy just to know how things work mechanically. He wants to understand why a little further by beyond that, and that's why you have many books written on the philosophy of science. Scientists, when they after they study science, they want to know what's the philosophy of science, and they and there are various philosophies that are that are expressed by different scientists, expounded by different scientists. So the so there's always the system itself, and then there's what's behind the system. And the same thing is true with halacha. There is the halacha, the science of halacha, and then there is the philosophy behind halacha. Now Maimonides is gives us some of the he has a section in his work where he explains the divine commandments, and I'm just going to go into it a little bit, all right? What is the reason for the Passover lamb? So he says as follows, and this is in chapter 46 in his third book, okay? And he says, the reason of the particular laws concerning the Passover lamb is clear. It was eaten roasted by the fire in one house and without breaking the bones thereof, okay? That's in Exodus 12. All right. In the same way as the Israelites were commanded to eat unleavened bread because they could prepare it hastily, so there were commandments for the sake of haste to roast the lamb because there was not sufficient time to boil it or to prepare other food. Even the delay caused by breaking the bones and to extract their marrow was prohibited. The one principle is laid down for all these rules. When the Torah says, "Ye shall eat it in haste," okay, and he continues, but when haste is necessary, the bones cannot be broken, nor parts of it sent from house to house, for the company could not wait with their meal till he returned. Such things would lead to laxity and delay, whilst the object of these rules was to make a show of the hurry and haste in order that none should be too late to leave Egypt with the main body of the people and thus exposed to the attacks of the evil designs of the enemy. Okay? So these temporary commandments were then made permanent, and some of them were made permanent, in order that we may remember what was done in those days. As it says, and thou shalt keep this ordinance in his season from year to year. Okay. And he goes and he continues to go on and on. But the main concept that he says here, which is that the night of Passover, The people had to eat the lamb in haste. So therefore, you couldn't waste time breaking their bones. You couldn't allow people to sit around and suck on the marrow of bones. And you couldn't boil it. Cooking could be a long process. It had to be roasted, which is quick. He said, this is all done, my mind, he says, to reflect the idea of haste so that the people, when they should always be aware of that concept. So when they left Egypt, they should leave all together and not have people, stragglers, which would be exposed to the enemy, to the attacks of the enemy. Okay, which is a very practical kind of explanation. Now, I want to tell you in general that most people are always very unhappy with Maimonides' explanations, because Maimonides' explanations are always practical. Okay, they're always practical. For instance, and he does not, as a general rule, he does not resort to any kind of symbolic interpretation. Okay? As a matter of fact, he says, and when he cannot find a reason, Maimonides just says he does not know the reason. All right? He does not try to force any kind of symbolic reasoning into his explanation. For instance, With regard to the hyssop grass and the sprinkling of the blood, he admits he does not know. He says to this day, he says it somewhere else, says with regard to the in another chapter here, but he says that he does not understand why he has not been able to find the reason for this is in chapter 47, okay, towards the end. He says, when he speaks about leprosy, he says, I do not know at present the reason of any of these things, nor why cedar wood, hyssop, and scarlet were used in the sacrifice of the red heifer, nor why a bundle of hyssop was commanded for the sprinkling of the blood of the Passover lamb. I cannot find any principle upon which to found an explanation why these particular things have been chosen. Now, you understand, Maimonides was a great genius, and he could very quickly come up with certain symbolic meanings. But Maimonides was not happy with symbolic explanation. He was only happy when he had a practical explanation. And most people are very disturbed with Maimonides' reasoning for the commandments, because they feel commandments have to be something more than just practical. Is that the whole thing? I mean, the whole reason is that they had to leave in haste? Okay, so that's why they... what's the concept over here? There must be some intrinsic value in this activity in the mitzvah, more than just haste. Okay? And I'd like to explain what Maimonides' position is. You see, Maimonides maintains, again, as the Talmud states, that the whole Torah is a tirade against idolatry and against primitive symbolic kind of performances where man thinks that he can just withdraw into his mind, do certain actions in private, and effectuate changes in reality. This is imagination, and this is an escape from reality. And that's what, in general, religions are. The Torah taught man something different. The Torah wanted to teach man that he must recognize reality. On the contrary, that was the purpose of the mitzvahs, of the commandments. One of the main purposes behind the commandment was to teach the people not to be like the Egyptians and to spend their lives in imagination and thinking what's going to happen to them when they're buried in a big tomb in the afterlife, or to get involved in all kinds of crazy activities which they think are affecting changes in reality. And the symbolic kind of the symbolic meaning, the Torah wanted to teach man to respect reality, to recognize that reality that we have is part of God's world that He created for us. He wants us to live in this reality. And we're not here by accident. We're here by design, God's design. So God wants man to live a life in conformity with those principles of reality that He has created for it. Okay? So, the Egyptian religion, was a religion that was based upon man's attempt to escape from reality and to have a life that's in line with what he imagines is good and what he wants. His emotions tell him that this is what he wants. How does he get it? He can't get it. He sees there are problems. So he escapes, and he thinks that by doing certain things, he's going to accomplish, bring about a world that a different world order, one that's in conformity with his imagination. But the Torah is just the opposite. The Torah teaches man to face reality and to realize that God wants man to live in this reality, and don't try to escape it, but you have to, on the contrary, your mission in life is to live with knowledge and reason and to understand and to operate and to function according to the intelligence, according to the divine element that God has implanted in the human soul. It's exactly the opposite, in other words. That is really the secret. That's really the idea behind all of Maimonides' explanations. Because according to Maimonides, that is the most vital message and the very unique message of Torah. That's why, according to Maimonides, halacha, the institution of halacha, and of course, you know, Maimonides was the finest of the Baalei Halacha, the greatest. And according to his whole work of his whole Yad HaChazaka is a masterpiece of halacha. So he knew very well what halacha was, and he knew very well, he understood the institution of halacha, and that's why he had a right, you know, to be a philosopher in Torah. You have to have knowledge. You can't just be problem as people try to philosophize when they don't even know what halacha is. Maimonides has a right to philosophize because he was a master of the Talmud and the whole system of halacha. And what he was saying was that the halacha basically always reflects a conformity to reality. That halacha always reflects reality, according to Maimonides, and teaches man that he must always look at reality and live according to reality. The people who are escaping from Egypt, don't imagine that you're just going to escape and rely on God. Yes, God is assisting you, but you have to be rational. If you're gonna have stragglers that are gonna be exposed to the enemy, they're gonna get killed. That's what's gonna happen. There's no two ways about it. What God will do for you, He will do, but you can never live an irresponsible life and expect God to intervene. That's not going to happen. That was the idea, according to Maimonides, of the halacha reflected. The halacha is very complex, very deep, but according to Maimonides, it reflected at the bottom, it reflected the main principle, the concept that man is living in reality and has to always recognize reality, not try to escape, but try to use his mind and his intelligence to live within the framework of reality. That's why Maimonides' explanations are not appealing to people, because most people are looking for religion to get them out of reality and to get them into a fantasy life. That's not what the Torah teaches. Okay. Basically, to get back to the main point, I would just like to give a definition of what Torah teaches us. What is the book? This is God's book. What does God's book teach us? Okay. Obviously, God's book cannot teach us everything about God, because our knowledge is very limited, and we can only understand a certain amount. But the Torah does teach us, the subject matter of the Torah does teach us something about God. What does it teach us about God? It teaches us how God relates to the universe, the laws of nature, how and when He intervenes with these laws. That is basically the most fundamental concept that the Torah teaches us. It teaches us how to live a good life, and it teaches us when God intervenes, when He doesn't intervene. Okay? And this is a great knowledge that the Torah conveys to us, but we have to approach it carefully and never deviate from what the Torah says, and then we can gain some insight if we do it properly. All right, not rashly, not according to our emotions, but according to the principles of the Torah itself. Okay. Now let's proceed slowly. When God created man, okay, and He placed him in the Garden of Eden. Now this Garden of Eden was a wonderful place to be. Okay, we'd all love to be there. Now the question that we have to ask is, what kind of a place was this? Did God tell man, look, I have created a fantasy land for you, and all you have to do is just sit back and relax, and you're just going to have ultimate pleasure. No worries, just complete pleasure. That's what most people think. That's what most people want, would like to have that situation. But when we look at the Torah itself, we don't find that that is true. First of all, we find in the creation of man that God speaks about man, and He says that man has a divine element. The divine element is knowledge, the ability to understand. Then God says that He instructs man to be fruitful, multiply, and to have dominion over the animals of the earth, and and to conquer, to be able to conquer the earth, which is means to be able to control the forces of nature. The only creature in the universe that has the ability to control the forces of nature. Every other creature is simply controlled by nature. You take away the habitat of an animal, that's it. The animal cannot survive. Man can take the laws of nature and bring it under his dominion. That was the first injunction given to man. So we see immediately that God created man with an intelligence, and He gave him an injunction to use that intelligence insofar as his life is concerned, to exercise his intelligence over the natural law, and to be able to use that intelligence to carve out for himself a good life. But it wasn't a passive situation. God didn't say, sit back, don't do anything, and you're just going to have total pleasure. Okay? It was a mandate. Now the question is, let's take a look at the Garden of Eden. When God placed man in the Garden of Eden, was it for man just to relax and just enjoy himself? Doesn't seem so. Take a look at Genesis 2:15. It says, after the description of the garden, it says, And God Almighty took the man, and he placed them in the Garden of Eden to work it and to watch it. What does that mean? What is to work it? Apparently, Adam had to work over there. We never think of Adam working in the Garden of Eden. What kind of work did Adam do in the Garden of Eden? He had two things. He had to work and to watch. So it wasn't something that just happened by... He couldn't just relax all day and enjoy himself. He couldn't even just think all day, okay? The way the Torah describes his primary activity, he started to classify the species, and he was thinking. Yes, he had time for that, but he also had to work the garden. Why did he have to work the garden? What is the answer? What kind of work was this? And how do we distinguish that work from later, the curse, where God says, with the sweat of your brow, you'll work the land? The answer is, when God placed man in the Garden of Eden, contrary to popular opinion, this was a continuation of the Adam that God created. The same mandate that is given in chapter 1 is more specific in chapter 2. And the mandate was to live according to reason and to exercise his knowledge in this garden. He has to work because this garden operates according to natural law, and man has to use his intelligence in order to secure for himself a happy environment in the garden. So he has to work the garden, he has to use his intelligence on how to work the garden, and he has to also guard it, okay? The only thing that he didn't have, which was given later in the curse, was, as the Torah describes, he didn't have the bramble bushes, the weeds, and the unwanted growths, which was a curse that was given to him later. But he was able to effectuate his need, have his life, his needs, and he didn't have any intervening things that were harmful that would come in and undo what he did. That he didn't have. When he worked, he had the results of his work. But the work was able to be successful according to a logical plan, because God created a logical world. Everything works according to reason. He gave man an instrument through which he could have knowledge and understanding, and through which he could be successful. But that was his mandate. His challenge was to live according to reality. There was only one commandment that God gave him at that time. What was the commandment? The commandment was, there's one tree that you cannot eat from. What was that commandment? The commandment was not to allow his imagination to overpower him. Not to think that one tree that he can't eat from, this is the greatest thing in the world, and if I only had that, who knows what kind of enjoyment I'd have. In other words, his mandate was to overcome his fantasies. And that's why you see in the biblical text how beautifully the Torah describes the sin. When man sins, it gives a vivid description of the alluring qualities of the tree, and that is I'm not going to read it for you, but you'll take a look at it. It's in Genesis 1. I'm sorry, Genesis 2. I was mistaken in my print over here. I don't know, what is it, Genesis? I have a misprint over here. It's 3. I'm sorry. It's 3:6. Okay? 3:6 gives a vivid description of the tree. Why does it give such a vivid description? It's good to the eyes, and etc., etc. The reason is because here the Torah is describing man's imagination and his fantasy. So he only had one challenge. The challenge was live logically, work the garden according to reason, and don't let your fantasy overpower you. That's all. If you lived that way, you would have been fine. Okay. Now, but you must remember the fact that the Garden of Eden was a logical situation where he had to use his mind. It wasn't a situation where he was just able to lay back and just have eternal pleasure. That was not the purpose of man's life. And that is not the purpose of man's life. So man, you see, was given a challenge, a charge, where he is responsible. He has a responsibility. Now let me just bring this down to a practical level, okay? It means to say that our world is a world in which, if man discharges his responsibilities properly, he will have one set of consequences. If he doesn't discharge his responsibilities properly, another set of consequences will be encountered by him. Okay? To give a simple illustration, if people, if you have a family living on the living on the fifth story in an apartment house, and parents allow toddlers to play by the window, and they are careless, then that means they are not living according to logic and reason, and the children will fall out the window, and they will get killed. Okay? If man lives according to reason, and he is careful, he will avoid that catastrophe. The results, the way a person lives, if a person lives according to reason and reality, and that's why I mentioned before, Maimonides says that the halacha always try to teach man to abandon primitive ways of life and to recognize reality and to live according to reality and to realize that you have a responsibility. Now, let me just explain the following. If the world was created in such a way that parents, let's take that example we just gave, parents who are negligent and simply go to sleep and they allow the little toddlers to play by a window on the fifth story. Now, if the child, the children would fall out the window and God would somehow magically save them. So you understand, we would be living in a different kind of a world. There would be no, it would not be a logical world, it would be an illogical world, and if you live like a fool, you'd have the same results as if you live like a wise man. Because God is going to step in and he's going to intervene. Every time you do a stupid thing where you endanger someone's life, God's going to step in, he's going to save the child. Okay? Now, you understand very well, if that were the case, what you're doing is you're obliterating the entire creation, the way God created man, and you're saying that if man lives like a fool, he will have the same results as if he lives like a wise man, which means there is no logical order. That's the end of the whole world of logic and reason and cause and effect and consequences, and it's a new kind of world, a fairyland kind of world, okay? That is not the world that the Torah describes. The Torah describes a world, that God placed us in a world where man is responsible, which means to say that if you live according to knowledge and wisdom, then you have one kind of a fate. You can effectuate your fate. If you live like a fool, then you're going to have another kind of fate. The problem is that people really want to escape the logical world that God created, and they want to live in a fantasy, an imagination world. That does not exist. This God never created. So you understand very well that it would be completely impossible for God to save man every time man does a stupid thing, because if he did that, then the whole life and the whole challenge of life which God has set forth for man could never exist. Okay? If the fool will have the same consequences as the wise man, then the whole system that God created in the universe is completely void. Alright? And man would never be challenged with or charged to live according to wisdom and reality, because if he lives like a fool, the same thing is going to occur. So there will be no laws of cause and effect, and there will be no difference in human life. If you live if you abandon all kinds of reason, you're going to have the same wonderful results as if you live according to reason. Obviously, such a world is not the world that God created, or that God could place man into and charge him with following a life of reason. Okay? So this is true with regard to man. All right. And it is true also with regard to society. You see, according to Torah, there are two entities, two things that have responsibility. One is the individual man, and then there is the entity of society. Society is also a responsible element, entity. In other words, let us say, what the Torah says like this, in my individual life, if I live according to reason, all right, so what happens? Now, here's a very important question, pivotal question. Let's say I live according to reason. So what does that mean? Does that mean that the effects of my reason of living an intelligent life. Of course, I will bear the fruits of the success of that result naturally from what I do, live according to reason. That I can expect, because that's the way the world works. But is that all, or does God intervene also? Okay, that's the question. Now here we find the answer is given to us in the Torah. But in order to get that answer, we have to come back to the point that I just mentioned before, that there are two responsible entities in the world. One is the individual man, and the second thing is the society on the whole. Now this can be seen, first of all, from the seven laws of Noah. Because the seven laws of Noah involve the individual, okay? For instance, the laws of idolatry, the laws not to eat part of the animal when it's removed during its lifetime, the laws of not to kill, not to murder, rather, not to steal, okay? Now, these laws are individual laws. But now you have one law, which is a societal law, and that is to set up the courts. So you see from the structure of the seven laws of Noah that there are two entities of responsibility. One is the individual, and the other is the society. Now, when God judges man, okay, he judges him according to the individual and also according to the society. Now, this means that as long as man cannot allow himself to act intelligently as an individual and act foolishly insofar as he's a part of society. If he does that, then he's also going to suffer ill consequences. Okay? How do we know that? We know that from the story of Sodom. And this is openly described in the Torah, where God informs Abraham that Sodom is going to be destroyed, and Abraham approaches God, and he says, just a moment. He says, heaven forbid, how could you do such a thing? How could you destroy the righteous and together with the wicked? All right? And then Abraham asks, and he says, if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom, will you forgive the city? And then he goes down, and 40, and then the 50. Then he goes down to from 50 goes down to 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. But after 10, he doesn't go anymore. That's it. So what does that show you? That shows you, he left, and it says, after he asked God, and then God says, yes, if there are 10 there, I will not destroy the city. And then what does it say? This is in Genesis 18:33, and God left after he concluded speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. So what does that mean? That means to say that God taught Abraham the secret of the responsibility of society. Abraham's question was not that how can a righteous individual suffer. That wasn't his question. His question was, when you have a society and there are righteous individuals, how many righteous people are necessary in order for the society to be considered righteous? Okay? So the list, 10 was the minimum. After 10, Abraham, that was it. So that means 2 righteous people, 5 righteous people can and will suffer harm in a society if the society is evil. Okay? So God judges an individual and he judges a society. They're both responsible entities. Now, this is insofar as God's judgment. You see, God intervenes and he gives judgment to man. And also God intervenes and he helps man as well. But when does he help man and how does he help man? He never helps man in a way that removes man's responsibility. For instance, in the Torah, what does it say? If you follow the laws of the Torah, you live according to God's ways, you follow God's ways, so then it says, I'll give the rain in its time, and the earth will give forth its produce, and I'll remove illness. But it never says in the Torah that if you live in the proper way, I'll remove murderers from the land. It doesn't say that. Okay? On the contrary, the Torah says, you must remove the evil from the land. So God helps man, but he never helps him in a way that he doesn't have any responsibility anymore. You see, he will never intervene and say that, well, if you follow the way of the Torah, then that's it. You're not going to have any more murderers in the you won't have any more thieves, you won't have any more murderers. No, that it doesn't say. It says that the rains will come in their time. There won't be any catastrophes. In other words, what God tells man is two things. If you, one is on an individual level, and the other is on a societal level. But let's take the society. If the society lives according to reason in every way, and they bring about the proper consequences that result from God's world that he created and from man living in line with that world, if man does that, then God will remove external happenings, external catastrophes that can destroy him, like hurricanes or various catastrophic things that can destroy man. Then God will take care of that area. But God will never take care of the area, no matter what, God will never take care of the area that directly involves human responsibility. Because that would mean that if the society lives like fools, that what's going to happen is God's going to intervene and God's going to save some of them. That's not going to work. Okay? The same thing is true on an individual level. If an individual lives according to wisdom and the knowledge of Torah, most of his troubles, practically all of his troubles, are gone because he has a good life. He's not overcome with greed. He knows how to choose a mate properly. He knows how to raise a family properly. So he doesn't have all the problems that we see. Certain things can befall even a good person. A person can get on a plane. A good person can get on a plane. A plane is destined to crash, and the individual will succumb. So this, the Torah teaches us, that if an individual lives a righteous life in every way possible, and he removes all the ill consequences based upon the fact that he lives a life of wisdom and knowledge, then God does intervene and protects him from extraneous happenings that may occur and are out of his control. That is where God intervenes, okay? But God never will intervene in either an individual who lives not according to reason or a society that doesn't live according to reason. Okay? In other words, if we would open up the doors of the jails in our society and allow all the criminals to go loose and children are killed, God will not intervene. If he did, then that would mean we could live in a crazy way and we're going to have the same miracles going to happen. They're just going to save those kids. This will never happen. Because if that happened, then man has no responsibility, and the whole idea, the God's whole plan, would be null and void. Okay? So the Torah teaches us how and when God intervenes. Now, in a society where people don't follow reason, and they don't follow the Torah's mandates, so then you have to expect that what's going to happen is that people are going to be harmed. And God is not going to intervene. In other words, to use this case to illustrate this case as an example, and I use it as an example because I don't wish to, I don't maintain that I'm an expert in political areas. But you know very well that there was a time when the government would have very strong surveillance on the various criminal elements and organizations that are anti-government. And then what happened was certain laws were passed, I believe in the 70s, where the FBI was unable to investigate because it was felt that it was deemed that this is not proper. You cannot spy on different organizations. Now, it makes sense. We understand there's a right of privacy, but it does not make sense, at least to me it doesn't make sense, that when you have organizations that are intrinsically hostile and irrational, that they should be protected by such laws. Now, if a society acts foolishly and is lax and acts in a way that is unintelligent, and because of that they are lax and they allow wicked people to have rights that should not have rights, okay, that's like opening up the doors of the jails and saying, well, let's get the criminals out and let's all be friendly with them. Okay, maybe they'll change if we're friendly. If people do stupid actions, they cannot expect God to intervene and to save them from the results of their folly, because doing that would be the same thing as just destroying the whole challenge and that man is placed with, that man is given. Okay, and man is placed on this earth in order to face that challenge. That God will never intervene in. That we can be guaranteed. The Torah teaches us that God will never intervene in such a case. Okay, so the concept that that people are looking for, what they're really looking for when they ask this question, was how can this happen, and how could these unfortunate incidents take place? They are looking for a world where there is no responsibility for the society, where the society can act irresponsibly and expect good results. God's going to magically make everything work well. That does not happen. Okay? The Torah does not teach such a philosophy. The Torah teaches responsibility for the individual and responsibility for the society. If the individual or if the society act in an irresponsible way, they can expect untoward results, because everything works according to God's wisdom, His knowledge, His laws of nature, and His laws of psychology, and His laws of ethics and morality, and therefore, when these laws are violated, there are natural consequences. Okay, so this is the answer that I am presenting to you. Now, of course, everybody's going to say, well, what happens to those children? Okay, they weren't at fault. The answer that we have for that is something which we cannot, there is no way that we can answer that question. The only thing we can say to that question is that God is just, and that's it. We cannot go into that area. What we can say is the Torah teaches us how and when God does intervene and when He does not intervene. That is the important thing to derive from the Torah. How we should act insofar as our life is concerned, our lives are concerned, and what is the situation that God gave us, and what is our responsibility, both on an individual level and a societal level. And those two levels...
Rabbi?
Yes?
You got less than a minute.
Okay. And those two levels do exist, and God will never break the natural law in order to save us from our folly if we insist on acting in a foolish way. Okay, that's basically it.